to the fourth case today, U.S. versus Cochran. Mr. Stewart.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Charles Stewart, and I am the attorney for the appellant Larry Cochran in this matter. Mr. Cochran was indicted by a federal grand jury in Hammond, Indiana, and charged with possession with intent to distribute 5 grams or more of cocaine base. He was subsequently convicted by a jury in November of 2007 and subsequently sentenced to 405 months in prison by Judge Moody. The appellant has timely filed his notice of appeal and docketing statements. I raised 2 issues in my brief, but because of time constraints, I'm only going to address one, and that is the issue of whether the trial court committed reversible error when it permitted the government prosecutor in his opening statement to comment on the defendant's absence from the courtroom during his trial. Prior to trial, at least for a long time, prior to trial, Mr. Cochran was representing himself pro se, and I was acting as standby counsel. But Mr. Cochran engaged in some rather bizarre filings, and the trial court, rightfully so, had concern that he would not be able to participate in a manner that is required in court, not to upset the decorum in the court and be respectful to the court. So prior to the trial, the district court asked Mr. Cochran if he would promise that he would basically obey himself, and Mr. Cochran said he wouldn't. At that point, the trial court revoked Mr. Cochran's pro se status and elevated my status from that of standby counsel to full counsel. Now, the trial, as I said, began in November of 2007. Mr. Cochran refused to be in the courtroom. The trial court rightfully, and we do not challenge that at all, rightfully excluded him from the courtroom, placed him in a holding cell, and had electronics set up so that he could hear and see the trial. During voir dire, prior to selection of the jury, the trial court advised the prospective jurors that Mr. Cochran had a right to be present during his trial or not to be present during this trial, and Mr. Cochran chose voluntarily not to be present, and they were not to consider that as evidence or any inference of guilt on Mr. Cochran. Ultimately, a jury was selected, and the prosecutor, Assistant United States Attorney, stated in his opening statement, essentially, you will notice that the defendant voluntarily is absent from the courtroom. At that time, I, as trial counsel, on behalf of Mr. Cochran, objected to that comment because it went against what Judge Moody had advised the jury during jury selection. And
What's the inconsistency?
Well, the inconsistency is that Judge Moody had told the jury they were not to consider the defendant's absence from the courtroom, if he chose to be absent, during the course of the trial or in the evidence.
Right. The opening statement didn't suggest that the jury should consider that.
Well, the implication was that it did. The only purpose, I suggest, in making a statement that the defendant was absent from the trial, obviously the jurors could see that. The trial court judge, Judge Moody, had advised them that he was going to be absent. The only purpose for the prosecutor to say that, Judge, is to imply that there was some sort of admission of guilt by the defendant in not being present. Additionally, when Judge Moody, sua sponte, during jury selection, had told the jurors, the defendant's absence is not going to be evidence, will not be considered by you of evidence. What is the purpose of the opening statement? An opening statement purpose is for either the government prosecutor or the defense attorney to outline what the admissible evidence is going to be against
This statement,
the other side.
This statement is kind of a goofy statement by the prosecutor, but the court continued to admonish the jury, right?
But
there were other instructions. And
okay.
This was just at the beginning of the trial, and the court continued to admonish the jury.
Okay. The problem with that is that when I objected on the prosecutor's statement about referencing the defendant's absence, the court overruled my objection. The court denied my motion to strike. The court did not readdress that issue until 2 days later when the court read its final instructions to the jury. And what I'm suggesting is if the court had said, after I objected, objection sustained, motion to strike is granted, move on, Mr. Prosecutor, there's no issue and we're not here. But that's not what the court did. The court said overruled Mr. Stewart, motion to strike denied, and reaffirmed what the government prosecutor's statement was. Also, in the cases that I've cited, this court and other court of appeals has said quite specifically that a government prosecutor, a member of the Department of Justice of the United States government, holds a special relation and has a special authority with the jury that they expect that assistant United States attorney to be fair. Now, when the government prosecutor says, after Judge Mooney had said, the defendant's absence is not evidence, then the government prosecutor says, well, the defendant is not here. The defendant is absent.
How did Officer Martinez identify Mr. Cochran as the person he saw?
I think we used, I believe the government, if my memory serves me correct, and if I'm not, I'm sure Mr. Nozick will correct me, I believe they went in the holding cell and perhaps took a picture of him, either that or a booking photo. We're not challenging the identification.
It seems to me that's what that statement relates to. Officer Martinez will testify that he followed a silver Mercury Cougar based on the tip. He sees a man who turns out to be Larry Cochran, who is not sitting before you today by his own choice.
Okay. My response to that is, number one, we did not challenge identification on that at all. Number two, and there were some discussions, however, of how the government was practically going to get an identification of the defendant if he wasn't present in the courtroom. But the government prosecutor doesn't have to say the defendant is voluntarily absent from the courtroom.
Well, he wasn't saying it gratuitously. This is the point in the opening statement when the government would ordinarily tell the jury that it would have a witness that would identify the defendant as the perpetrator, except that the defendant isn't sitting in the courtroom.
Okay.
So in context, as Judge Keeney has pointed out, that's what was going on here. It wasn't an impermissible commentary on his absence. It was a statement of the obvious.
Well,
he's not here.
I respectfully disagree with the judge, because all they would have had to say is that we are going to have Officer Martinez identify the defendant through a photograph as the individual that Officer Martinez arrested on the date of the crime. He doesn't have to say, first of all, that he was absent, but then to add the word voluntarily.
All he's doing is repeating what the judge said in the instruction. I fail to see how that can possibly be impermissible.
The government prosecutor didn't say that you cannot use the defendant's absence as evidence against him.
But he didn't make any suggestion to the contrary. He just stated the obvious, that he's not sitting here by his own choice. The jury was already instructed about that, and then he moved on with the rest of his opening statement.
The point is, the judge had already said that the defendant's absence was not going to be evidence.
Nothing that the attorneys say in opening or closing statement is evidence, and the jury's instructed on that.
But the only purpose of the opening statement is to outline to the jury what admissible evidence is going to be presented. This was not admissible evidence. Additionally,
it wasn't evidence at all. All it was the fact of the trial procedure.
No, I would suggest it went far beyond that, because there was no purpose of saying that the defendant is voluntarily absent if not to imply that that his voluntary absence was admission of guilt. And additionally, as I stated earlier, what the district court should have done to clear this up was to have sustained the objection of the defendant and struck the comment. The district court, after initially telling the prospective jurors during jury selection that it could not consider the absence of the defendant, by overruling my objection and by denying my motion to strike, confirmed for 2 days the jury was left wondering, well, can we consider this evidence? The judge said no first, but then the prosecutor said we can, and then the judge overruled the defendant's objection. Maybe we can consider his absence. And that wasn't clear up until 2 days later. There are cases that I cited in my reply brief that one of the things that the court looks at to determine if there is prejudice is if there is a lapse of time between the error and then the curing of the error. In this case, there was 2 days. That's significant.
Can I just ask you a question on a related topic? This sentencing took place after the Supreme Court's decision in Kimbrough, so I assume since this issue wasn't raised, in your view, the district court properly exercised its discretion under Kimbrough.
We are not challenging the sentencing at all. The only two issues we're challenging are the issue I've argued this morning and the second issue in my brief, which was the seizure, the stop and seizure of Mr. Cochran's vehicle on the date he was arrested.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. David Nozick on behalf of the government. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Northern District of Indiana. I also happen to be the AUSA that tried the case. Defense counsel, I believe, misstates the purpose of the statement and the extent of the statement. He argues that the government tried to have the jury infer guilt by saying he's not here. There's nothing in the record whatsoever to support that. He said in his argument just now that I said, or the government said, you will notice he's not here. No one said you will notice. There was nothing ever said about inferring guilt. The government didn't say, why isn't Mr. Cochran here? And there was nothing at all which would call into question constitutionally protected rights, such as the right against self-incrimination. Now, there is a key case right on point from this district. The Honorable Judge Bauer, Chief Judge Bauer, wrote the decision. That is the case of Resnover, R-E-S-N-O-V-E-R, versus Pearson, cited to in my brief. Defense counsel does not deal with that case whatsoever, and that's a case that is on all fours squarely against him. Now, the only distinction in that case is that it didn't happen during the evidence portion, the guilt portion of the trial. It happened during the penalty phase of a trial. It was an Indiana state death penalty case. The defense counsel mentioned in passing that the defendant voluntarily was not there, and this honorable court specifically said that there was nothing improper about that, because merely pointing out the absence of a defendant is different than commenting on the privilege against self-incrimination. If the government in this case had said, why isn't he here? He's not here to testify. Then, of course, I'd be commenting on a constitutionally protected right. But I don't believe there's any case out there that the defense found, and certainly no case that I found, that says the right to not be present is a constitutionally protected right. Of course, the right to be present for your own jury trial is a right protected by the Constitution. There's no constitutional right not to be there. So simply, as you said, pointing out the obvious, which was already said by the court, which is instead, during the time in opening statement where the government would normally point to the defendant and say, and he saw Mr. Cochran sitting right there, well, that's taken away from us. So I'm left with, and he saw a person who turned out to be Mr. Cochran, who by his own choice isn't here today. And I moved on without any further comments.
But it is interesting that the trial court said before closing argument that you could not make any comment on the defendant's absence from the courtroom. And that was really the direct opposite from how it had ruled on the defendant's objection during the opening.
Well, Your Honor, you'll note that that's a good point. You'll note that there's time for motions in limine, and no motion was ever brought up by the defense to preclude me from mentioning it. The court, when they dealt with the issue, they said they will, you know, the Honorable Judge Moody said he will instruct the jury that they're not to consider it. No one ever said anything about that it can't be mentioned as a mere fact. In an abundance of caution, after the defense's argument, the Honorable Judge Moody specifically said, let's steer away from that. And I had no problem with that, of course, because the jury already knew what the situation was and already knew the defendant wasn't there. But at no point was there anything suggesting that it was improper just stating the fact in passing in the opening statement. And I don't think Judge Moody was going back upon his previous decision when he admonished us not to mention it. He just wanted it steered away from. And perhaps if I mention it over and over, well, then at that point in time, at some point, the jury could be thinking, what's the government getting at? What do they want us to conclude?
When did you reach the agreement on how the defendant would be identified as a person that an officer noticed?
Your Honor, I can recall that the way he was identified is that I had Officer Nicole Dunkinson of the Hammond Police Department either go back to the holding cell or one of the marshals took a photo of him in the holding cell. She looked at it, saw that it was him, and on the stand she testified. I had the opportunity either to see the photo or see the man in the holding cell, and that's Larry Cochran.
When was that procedure agreed upon?
Respectfully, Judge, I cannot recall. It was obviously before she took the stand, but it was not before opening statements.
It was not before
opening. No, but there was a concern. How are we going to have him identified?
I asked the question.
Yeah, there was a concern and a question in my mind, how is it he'd be identified? And to be candid, I thought that the government was disadvantaged by not having him there because, one, you have the issue of how you can identify him. Two, to be honest, I think a jury is going to be left with the impression, why isn't he here? Is the government trying him in absentia? He doesn't even know he was charged, maybe, or going behind his back and doing it. It's not fair that this guy doesn't have a chance to protect himself. So to be honest, I thought the whole procedure weighed against the government as opposed to weighing against the defendant. I saw nothing improper about
That's
saying...
Agreement was, but it wasn't made. How you identified it wasn't done before opening statement.
To be candid with the court, Your Honor, I'm not positive. Those are my points. I'd obviously argue harmless error. I'd obviously argue that the case law that says that juries are presumed to follow the court's instructions, and I believe that they did in this case. I will rest upon my brief. If you have no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Newman.
Thanks.
Mr. Stewart, your time had elapsed, but I'll give you a minute.
I'd like to respond in that minute, at least partially, to Mr. Nozick's comment that before opening statements there was no order in limine. There was an order by the trial court. The order was not that the defendant's absence from the courtroom could not be considered by the jury. Now, what Ms. Nozick is saying is if we had followed that up with a motion to eliminate directing the government prosecutor not to mention it, then he would have followed that. But implicit in that argument is he knows that what he said in the opening statement about the absence of the defendant was improper. And if he had been ordered by the court not to say it, he wouldn't have. It's kind of an interesting argument. In addition, I would suggest that Judge Moody's sua sponte order eliminate clearly prior to closing arguments directed to the government not to mention anymore the absence of the defendant was a clear recognition by Judge Moody that he had not handled the situation during the opening statement properly. We would ask the court after consideration to reverse the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Stewart, you took this case on behalf by appointment?
Yes, I did.
You have the appreciation of the court for your representation of your client. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.